Welcome to ApacheCon, welcome to TomCatCon, part of ApacheCon, and welcome to the State of the Cat presentation, where I'm going to talk a little bit about the current state of the TomCat project. Start off with a quick introduction. For those of you who haven't met me before, my name is Mark Thomas. You'll find me posting on the TomCat list as Mark T. I've been involved in the project since 2003. I've been on the PMC since 2005, and I do a bunch of other stuff around the ASF as well. I help out in Commons, I mentor Dubbo, I do a little bit of infrastructure and some other bits and pieces. But I spend the majority of my time working on Apache Tomcat, and it's as the Tomcat Committee that I'm here talking to you today. So, what I'm going to spend most of today doing is looking back over what's happened in the last 12 months. Remy's going to be talking a little bit about future plans, future ideas, things we'll be doing next in the next session, so I don't want to steal too much of his thunder. So let's dive straight in as to what's happened. Well, community-wise, Emmanuel joined the PMC. That's good for the Tomcat community because Emmanuel is the Debian maintainer for Tomcat packages, so that gives us a really good hook into one of our significant downstream users. They provide us some useful feedback from them, and we can also provide them some help and advice on getting security issues fixed. So that's working really well. And IL, who's sat down here at the front, has joined us as a committer as well. So now we have a total of 18 committers, around 4 of whom are active, and 27 PMC members, about half of whom are active. The reason that those numbers are somewhat skewed towards the PMC being more active than the committers is quite simply that any committer that hangs around for about 6 months or so and stays active, we're pretty much going to put them on the PMC at that point. So the active committers tend to go onto the PMC. The people who aren't active, they're people that have contributed to the project in the past. We still see them from time to time, still see them occasionally, but they're still technically part of the PMC. And of course, if they ever want to come back and scratch an itch, contribute a bit more, they are, of course, more than welcome to come active again. We had, just under 12 months ago, we ran our first independent event as a Tomcat community. We ran TomcatCon in London. That had about 20, 25 attendees. It was very successful in that it was great to interact with part of the community in the UK that we hadn't seen. Some of whom we hadn't seen before. What was particularly good about it was we actually ended up with a small financial surplus from that event. And what that has given us is the ability to underwrite future events. So using that, we ran a training course in the UK up in Manchester. And we were able to do that without there being at any point any financial risk to either the foundation, to Tomcat project itself, or the individual PMC members who are actually setting it up. And we're looking for more opportunities to run more events like that. And we really have some fairly simple criteria for those events. So if you want a Tomcat event in your area or in your company, what we're looking for is it needs to be open to the public, it needs to be ultimately cost neutral to the project. We don't mind if you have to front some money up front to cover booking costs, but ultimately it needs to be cost neutral. Open to the public. That's pretty much it. So there are all sorts of models that can work in that. We can do it completely independently, like we did with the Tomcat training. If you work for a large company and you want to do something within your company, one way of doing that is, let's say you've got space for 40 people, you have 20 for your company, you let us sell the other 20 places to a member of the public. We use the ticket sales from members of the public to cover our costs, and yet it ends up being cost neutral. There are lots of different models, but if you're interested in running an event, come and talk to us and we'll find a model that works. But as long as it's cost neutral, it's no sort of financial risk, so we don't have to sort of sign up to potentially paying out tens of thousands of dollars or something. And it's open to all of the Tomcat community, even if bits of it's reserved to your company or whatever, then that's fine, we can make that work. Come and talk to us. We're interested in doing more of these events, and we can do them pretty much anywhere. If we've got Tomcat committers locally, great, we can use those. If not, well then, we just have to be a little bit more creative about how we end up covering the travel costs. But there are ways to make these things work. When we first announced TomcatCon London, well, when are you going to do an event in India? Which was just as soon as you find a local company that's willing to sponsor the travel to get the committers out there to do it. Otherwise, happy to do it, but we need to cover our costs in that respect. And they're not actually that bad. Flying for one or two committers, a local hotel, it's not actually that much. If you think of it in terms of what it would cost to run an in-house training course for Tomcat compared to flying, it's not, the costs aren't that they're more in favour of just running an event like this. So if you want to do that, you know, please come and talk to us. Manchester was successful as well. We had, I think, 9 people to the training course. We ended up making a surplus of about $20, I think, on that. But that was very carefully planned. We basically, oh, right, it's going well, right, great. They're not having the cold sandwiches, they can have the hot lunch now. So we made it slightly nicer. Oh, great, we've got a little bit more, great, we can give them notebooks with the Tomcat logo. Got one here, I think. Where is it? Yeah. The attendees all went home with one of these, because we could afford to do it. It also let us try out a swags vendor we were looking to do some work with. But that was a very successful day, worked very well. And then we did the EU Roadshow as well in Berlin. That was a great event, worked really well, co-located with FOSS backstage, met lots of new people. And now we've got this one. We need to start thinking about running the next event as well. That's probably going to be around New Year-ish, but when details, haven't really talked about that yet. That's something we need to discuss on the users list. But we've got this surplus fund that lets us basically pay up front for venues and stuff. We've got the flexibility to do these things, and we want to do more of it where we can. So release-wise, it's been a fairly typical busy year for Tomcat releases. So each of these X's represents a release. So as you can see, for 9.0 and 8.5, they've been roughly monthly. I say roughly because, you know, December holiday period tends not to get a release then. And can you spot which month I went on my summer holiday? Obviously, yes, it was July, so we didn't get a release then either. So. But typically, we're sticking to the monthly release cycle, and we're finding that that's working very well. And because with every Tomcat release, we aim to fix all of the open bugs, not enhancement requests, just the bugs, it does mean if you find a bug in Tomcat and you report it to us, then by middle of the next month, you'll have a release with a fix for it, assuming we can reproduce it. If we can't reproduce it, things get a little tricky. It just takes us a bit of time to figure out where the problem is, usually. But if it's something that's reproducible, yeah, it'll be fixed by next month, no problem. And we've been doing that now for a number of years. So each one of those releases, we've always fixed all of the open bugs at that point. We're also making a reasonable dent in the enhancement requests, and I'll talk about that in a little bit as well. End of June was end of life for Tomcat 8.0, so the final release for that was early in July. We're not planning any more 8.0 releases. 8.5 should be a drop-in replacement. You might need to make a few configuration changes, but if you do try 8.5 and it doesn't work, or there's some sort of incompatibility, let us know. It's probably a regression, and we'll look to fix it. 7.0, that's been released about every 2 months on average. It's partly driven by availability, it's partly driven by is there a security fix we need to pick up, it's partly driven by is the change log starting to look a little bit too long and we really need to get the release out. But it's roughly every 2 months. Native, that seems to be settling down to about every 6 months. There, what we're really doing is picking up the handful of bug fixes that we've had. We haven't really had anything significant there. So that's on a roughly 6 monthly release cycle where we'll pick up the bug fixes. We might implement a couple of enhancement requests, mostly bug fixes. And ModJK is on the same release cycle, although there will be another ModJK release in October. Ideally we need to do it this month, but we just found another regression, so we're going to need to re-roll the release, which means the release isn't likely to happen until early October. But that again is on 6 monthly. The only reason we're doing one now is, as I say, the couple of regressions that we've spotted in the September release that we want to get fixed. And again, with that, it's mostly bug fixes, the odd enhancement request, but mostly just the picking up the bits and pieces of bugs that have accumulated over the 6 months. So if we look back for Tomcat 9 for the last 12 months, Java EE, that was released back a year ago now in 2017. We were able to get the first stable 9 release out quite soon after that. And 9.04 is quite early in our release numbering to have a release that's stable. Normally we're up around the 16, 17, early 20s maybe. The reason it was so much earlier for Tomcat 9 was simply because Java EE8 took forever to arrive. So we had like 25 milestone releases before we had the first 9.0 release waiting for the spec to go final. So we'd actually got quite a bit of testing ironed out a lot of the wrinkles by the time the spec went final, and it just took us 4 more releases and we got our stable release, and that was back in January. And that's been going really well. And generally, feedback in Tomcat is very stable these days. Often I go, on the back of the Tomcat Con in London, that was sponsored by Liferay, they got me to go to their own user conference because they often use Tomcat. And I'll go around and talk to all the Liferay users and they'll tell me all of the things, all the Tomcat problems they're having, and that'll give me a great bunch of really useful information to go and put into Tomcat. And essentially every single person I spoke to said, oh no, Tomcat, it just works, it's fine, it's not a problem.
To be, and generally we're finding that across all of the Tomcat releases, and a lot of that is because we're fixing all of the open bugs once they get reported and they're there in the next release. We don't have this long list of 400 or 500 bugs that nobody's quite got round to looking at yet. We've looked at them all, we've fixed the ones that are actually bugs, and we've closed the ones that aren't, and I think that's really a strength of the project that we've got. We're on top of that, as it were. Something else we've been doing in the last year, our relationship with Oracle and their JDK team has got a lot better. And 4 or 5 years ago, you'd find a JRE bug, you'd report it to Oracle. If you were lucky, you'd get a response in about 4 or 5 months saying, yeah, that looks like it might be a problem, and it'll end up on the bug list and nothing will ever happen. And it got to the point where I got fed up doing that because there was no point. And then back when work was starting on Java 9, the JDK JRE team approached us and said, look, we're approaching lots of open source projects. Can you test Tomcat on Java 9 and let us know what the problems are? So we said, yeah, sure, no problem, happy to help. No Java 9 specific problems, but by the way, there's this huge bunch of memory leaks over here that we reported ages ago. It'd be really good if you could actually get them fixed. Oh, yeah, and lo and behold, they got fixed, and that relationship got really improved from that point. And a lot of that was a couple of years ago. We fixed the bulk of the memory leaks. Most of them got backported to 8 as well, so that's great. But in the last year, we found there's another memory leak in the fork join pool. And pretty much all of these memory leaks are related to class loaders and starting threads and the thread retaining a reference to the current class loader. And if that current class loader happens to be a web application class loader, that's fine up until the point where you try and reload the web app, and at which point you've usually got a memory leak because the thread pool is thread's still running. It's still retaining a reference to the class loader that should have been thrown away and hasn't been, and bingo, memory leak. So we found another one of those in the fork join pool, so that's been fixed. We've done similar testing with Java 10 and Java 11, and we found with those that there's a really ugly stack trace triggered on Tomcat startup on Java 10. Impact was absolutely nothing. It was just an ugly stack trace. The functionality-wise, it didn't change a thing, but we got it fixed anyway. We worked around it in Tomcat, and they fixed it in 11. And in the 11 testing, we found that some of our TLS tests broke as soon as we ran them on Java 11. And there we discovered a lovely little bug in the, let me get this right, the client-side TLS 1.3 implementation. So what would happen was it would start a connection to a server. They'd negotiate TLS 1.2. That was all fine. the server, for some reason, would say, oh, I need to renegotiate this. It would go back to the client, and the client would then try and connect with TLS 1.3, at which point the server says, I've got no idea what nonsense this is, never seen it before, close the connection. And that was a client-side bug. They were basically reintroducing TLS 1.3 after they'd been told the server didn't understand it. So we've got that fixed as well. So it's a, say it's a really good relationship with the JRE team. We're finding bugs, they're fixing them. And generally, we're not finding problems in Tomcat running on these later JREs. And the closest we get is, because Tomcat has to do annotation scanning for servlet 3 onwards, then when the class format changes, then we just need to update the that bit of the code to do the annotation scanning. But for the last couple of releases, it's been as simple as, right, yeah, tell Tomcat the new version exists. Right, two lines of code, tick, tick, right, job done, move on. Not that big a deal. Actually, we put that into Commons Beckle and then transfer it across, but it hasn't been a big deal. So getting Tomcat to run on these later JREs hasn't been particularly problematic at all. And as I say, we've got this really good relationship now with Oracle in getting the JRE bugs that we find fixed. So Java 9's been and gone in the last 12 months. 10 has been and is almost gone. I think Java 11 is due sometime this week. I forget exactly. I'm pretty sure it's this week. So that's almost here, and I think that's going to be the long-term support one. At least that's the current plan. And then what that means for Tomcat is really not a huge amount so far. As I say, Tomcat's worked quite happily on all of these later releases. We haven't really had any major problems. We're not anticipating any particular issues. We might get some problems once they start turning some of the stuff they deprecated in Java 9 and said, you really shouldn't be calling these APIs, stop doing it. And Tomcat has carried on doing that, usually because we need to do it for the memory leak protection to work out where the application has done something that it shouldn't, so we can give you the apps a meaningful error message to say, you've got a memory leak because you've done this, as opposed to saying, you've got a memory leak, but we don't know where or why. And some of the APIs we use to get that more detailed information, those have been restricted and are at some point going to be removed. And at that point, we will be in a position where we can just provide less information. And the answer will be, yes, you have a memory leak. Now you're going to have to go and get a profiler to tell you where, because we can't. But that hasn't happened yet, so we're still good all the way up to Java 11. Talked about bugs and enhancements earlier. So in the last year, we fixed about 150 bugs, and that's individual bugs. So if we fixed it in 9, 8, 5, 8, 0, and 7, I haven't counted it multiple times. I've only counted it once. So I could argue it's more like 500 bug fixes there. But one of the nice things with the Tomcat codebase is backports are pretty easy these days. It's normally just a case of, yeah, SVN merge, oh, look, I've backported it, it's fine. So it's not a huge amount of work, but 150 genuine bugs. There's another 100 or so that have been resolved, normally in the variation of, no, that's a configuration error, or no, that's what the spec says it has to do. So we've closed out about 100 of those as well. And at any one time, there's normally about 5-ish open bugs that we're working on. I think it's a little bit less than that at the minute. And the enhancement requests are now down to less than 90. I think if I close all of the open bugs, it's about 88, 87, I think. We have closed the one that was more than 10 years old. So that was a real feeling of achievement. Yeah, and that was to do with customizing error pages. So what's often fun with Tomcat is people want to put customized error pages in for whatever reason. You know, they don't want to expose the Tomcat version number. They don't want the standard error message. They want a prettier error message. That's all fine. But when the error happens so early in the processing chain that we don't even know which web app it's meant to be, or we don't even know which host the request is meant to be for, because the request is so problematic, it's then much more difficult to produce a customized error page, because it's, well, which application do I go and look in to find the customized error page for this thing? So what we've done is added some options where you can provide, they have to be purely static content, they can't be JSPs, they can't be servlet, it's just a static HTML page. but you can provide a static HTML page and map it to either an error code or an exception, much like you would a custom error page in a server. And that can actually then apply to any error pretty much anywhere in the processing chain. So that was something that had been open for about 10 years, which was nice to just close that one off. For the remaining 87, 88, whatever it is, it's a case of working through them slowly and fixing them one at a time and very slowly over time bringing that number down. And to some extent, there are advantages to leaving them open for a while because it gives us the opportunity to judge, well, okay, one person wanted this, but that's actually quite an invasive change. So are there lots of other people that want this as well that make it worth doing? Or is that something that we say, well, look, the hooks there are there so you can do that yourself. This is what you need to do. Here's some hints. Off you go. Ask us on the user list if you need help. So we can make those sorts of judgments as to whether it makes sense to actually put it into Tomcat or not. In terms of lines of code, it's very slowly creeping up. It's about 130,000 at the moment. But it hasn't changed that much in the last 5, 6, maybe longer years. It's hovered between about 120,000 and 130,000 lines. And that's despite us adding, you know, huge chunks of new features like WebSocket, HTTP2, all the other stuff in the servlet APIs as well. And the reason we've managed to keep the lines of code down is partly because we do cleanup and refactoring as we go along, dealing with the removing duplicated code. Partly it's spotting things like some bits of the Tomcat code are really quite old. Some of it dates back to the point where the XML parsers provided by the JRE were so bad, nobody ever used them. And I was digging around in our JSP engine, Jasper, one day, thinking, why have we got this XML parser here? Well, okay, I know why we've got it there, because it dates back from when you couldn't trust XML parsers to behave properly, so we had to write our own. Well, fair enough, but why have we still got it here? Traced it all the way through, and we had about 3,000 lines of code that were solely there, so we could, effectively, all it was being used for was to identify the encoding of a JSP file. That got replaced with about 10 lines. And bingo, big chunk of code. Okay, the first version had a few regressions, and we had to fix it, but we fixed it the second time round. So it's fixes like that as well, looking at those sorts of things, where we're able to clean things up, take advantage of newer APIs. So the lines of code have stayed about the same. Not everything's been plain sailing. We've had a couple of hiccups. And this request line validation is, in particular, is an interesting one in that it illustrates a not uncommon pattern. So I'll try and keep this short. If I skip over things and you want more detail, come and find me later this week and I'll happily bore you to death with hours and hours of detail on this. But essentially, we had a security vulnerability, and that vulnerability was essentially we weren't correctly parsing the request line. There were some invalid characters in there that we weren't handling correctly, and that was allowing a certain malformed request to be processed by Tomcat, and it was effectively it's a response splitting vulnerability. So, okay, we could just fix the one specific problem that was reported, but that's generally not the best way of doing these things. So, okay, given that this has happened because we're not following the spec properly, let's go back to first principles. Let's actually read the specs again and go through them with a fine tooth and actually implement the spec against the request line and make sure that if there are any other vulnerabilities that we haven't seen, that haven't been reported, let's close those down now. Let's fix it all in one fell swoop. So we went through and followed the specs and tidied it up. All was good for about maybe 2 days, maybe possibly three. And we started getting reports. My web app doesn't work. I've just upgraded and it stopped working. What's the problem? Well, my request's being rejected. Okay, can you tell us the URI? They'd show us the URI. Yeah, that's raw JSON you've put in the query string. It's using curly brackets. Curly brackets have to be encoded. You can't put them raw in the URI. They have to be percent NN encoded if you follow the specs. So there's a little bit of back and forth with people saying, oh, yeah, but it worked before. Well, yes, it doesn't now because we've closed all of these potential security holes. And, well, if you just followed the specs in the first place, well, nobody else enforces. And, yeah, they will be, trust me. So we went back and forth a bit. And then we got to the point where somebody said, this is a bit of a problem for us because we can't fix the clients because they're embedded devices in about 1 million-plus cars, and fixing it would require a recall. Now, I kind of bit my tongue at that point because what I really wanted to say was, and your plan, if you actually have a security vulnerability and you have to change the clients, is what exactly? But I bit my tongue. I think I probably said that on a private list somewhere. And what we ended up doing was putting in some options for allowing the request line validation. The characters that were most frequently abused, which were curly brackets and pipe, we basically added configuration options to say, OK, if you really want Tomcat to let these through, set this configuration option, it'll let it through. It settled down for a bit. We went through a few more patterns of people saying, oh, my client's broken, and us saying, well, yeah, well, actually, yes, your client is broken. It's not percent NN encoding according to spec. Go fix your client. And that bubbled on for maybe as long as 6 months until the client in question, I think, was Mozilla. And one of our users took us at our word and said, well, okay, fair enough. They're not implementing the specs. We'll go and create a bug report against Firefox. They duly did. And it got rejected on the grounds of, yeah, these RFC things. No, we don't follow those specs. We've written our own. This is the spec that the browsers are following. Sigh. Groan. So I go and look at the spec, and if you've never looked at RFCs, then what I said, the HTTP RFCs are very well written. They are crystal clear. They are absolutely precise. There is very little ambiguity in them. They are very nice specifications to work with as an implementer. So I went to look at the ones that the browsers had written, and it was essentially pseudocode. I could not work out which characters were allowed and which ones weren't by reading the spec, because you would have literally had to, for each character, work your way through the pseudocode to see whether it's allowed or not. And it was, there's an easy way of doing this. I'll just run a test with I'll do work with Firefox, with Chrome, and with IE, and I'll just test which characters it encodes and which ones they don't. And then I'll reverse engineer what their spec is that way. Not one of the browsers behaved the same way. So there's a chance one of them is implementing the spec they claim to be implementing. So it's equally likely, actually none of them are, but not one of them behave in a consistent way, which kind of makes the whole nonsense of having a spec in the first place if you're all going to do something different. But what this highlighted was that, the browsers were point blank not going to change the way they behaved. However hard we tried, it just wasn't going to happen. And secondly, there are actually a whole bunch of other things that were going to cause problems for some users for some edge cases. So we went back and said, right, okay, let's redo the configuration options for this request line stuff. Let's give the users even more control than we gave them before. And essentially what you can do now is for all of the characters that should be percent NN encoded, you can separately decide for both path elements and the query string whether or not you want Tomcat to require them to be percent NN encoded. So you now and you can do that on a per connector basis. So you've now got enough flexibility to work around whatever the clients are doing. But fundamentally, if you've got control of the client, the best option would be to actually implement it. So having gone around that boy and had all of that fun, we thought, okay. Whilst we were looking at this, we'd also realised that the host names weren't being validated correctly. Well, at all, in fact. Let's validate those as well. But let's learn some lessons from the request line, and let's not try and get ourselves into a position where we're breaking stuff for lots and lots of users. So we said, OK, well, we'll implement it, make sure we're happy with it. Then we'll introduce it in a logging-only mode, so it won't break anything. It will just say, Tomcat doesn't think this is valid. And in a future version, it's going to reject it. If you think this is wrong, basically let us know so we can fix the parsing. So we ran that, and I think we had a couple of bug reports around IPv6 and some things that we were allowing that shouldn't have been, and vice versa. So the IPv6 stuff got all tidied up. That was all good. Thought, okay, yeah, this seems okay. No other problems. Okay, let's flip the switch and actually get Tomcat to reject it now. And that's when the next problem occurred, because there were some users obviously hadn't tested with it, and we hit two more regressions. One was we only allowed alphas in the final component of a domain name, so we assumed they were all .com, .org, .whatever. And I say we, I mean I, because it was my mistake. I read the spec, and the spec strongly implies that that's the case. What I hadn't read was the errata, which said, well, yes, that's what the spec says, but A, if you actually look at the specification of what's actually allowed, we allow more than that. Oh, and for an international domain name, you have to have more than that, because you need dashes and you need numbers as well. So anyway, we fixed that. It was a one-line change, and it was actually submitted by a contributor, which was nice. So we fixed that one, and I thought it was all done and dusted, and then I think a couple of weeks ago, somebody pointed out, oh, yes, it's actually legal to have a dot on the end of a domain name. So www.apache.org dot is actually a legal domain name, and the dot is there to tell you that that's actually the end of the domain name and it finishes there. If you've ever set up DNS and you set up files, you always put a dot on the end, and it's to disambiguate between local names that might have some other extension and ones that are actually fully qualified. But 999 times out of 1,000, nobody ever bothers with the final dot. So yeah, Tomcat didn't let that through, so that was a little bit problematic. So that's been fixed. But it was better. It caused less disruption than the request line, but it still caused some disruption. I think the lesson there for us is that we just need to, however long we think we need to allow to give it a chance for users to use it, to test it, to find the bugs, allow longer, essentially. Always allow longer, because the people's upgrade cycles are always a lot longer than you think. And in terms of hiccups, those aren't disastrous. And because we have this monthly release cycle, we were able to fix most of them pretty quickly. It's just, you know, things that we can look at so we don't make the same mistake again. And I've clearly been talking too long on that slide because the screensaver kicked in. Right. Quickly look at some security stuff that's happened in the last year. I'm just pulling out the highlights. So CVE 2018, 1304, and 1305, those were to do with mapping security constraints to servlets. I forget which way round they were, but one of them was that, now was it servlet 3 or servlet 3.1, introduced a new servlet mapping, which was specifically for requests to the root of the web application context. And we had basically missed that in our security constraint parsing. So any security constraints that were explicitly configured for the root of the context weren't being applied, so we fixed that one. And the other one was an interesting side effect of allowing security constraints to be defined by annotations. And the problem here is that imagine you have a servlet. One servlet is mapped to /foo*, and the other is mapped to /foo/bar*. Okay? So any request that starts with foo xyz, that will go to the foo servlet. If it's foo bar abc, that will go to the foo bar servlet. However, if you map a security constraint to /foo*, it applies to all of those URLs. So if /foo and /foo bar both get that security constraint. This is where it gets interesting. You can specify security constraints in annotations to servlets, and those constraints pick up the URL mappings of that particular servlet. But because If you imagine you define a servlet that's mapped to foo/foo/star, if you set a security constraint on that servlet, it will also apply to the servlet that's mapped to /foo/bar/star, even though that servlet's in a separate file with separate annotations. And what was happening was the annotations were only being processed at load time. So what would happen is you could access a servlet on /foo/bar/star, and no security constraints would be applied. You'd have free access to it. Then you'd access the servlet mapped to /foo/star, at which point Tomcat would read the security constraints, apply all of those security constraints to that point onwards, including to request to /foo/bar/star, which meant, depending on the order you requested your servlets, would depend on whether the security constraints were applied or not. And that's generally a bad thing, because the security constraints should have applied consistently to everything all the time. So that was a fix there that we had to do to basically go through and look for the security constraints from the get-go and make sure they were applied. I actually think it was an unintended consequence of some of the adding annotations. Personally, I hate annotations in terms of a configuration style, simply because as a system administrator, if I come along trying to work out, well, which servlet is this thing mapped to, the answer is, well, it's whatever the annotation said that's buried in the code. If I haven't got the source code, I can't find it. I know XML is generally not liked because it's long and it's verbose, but yes, it tells me what's going on. Personally, as a system admin, I like the XML because I can look at it and I know exactly what servlet and filters it will have been mapped to. But anyway, I digress. 1307, that was a race in async timeouts. And essentially what ended up happening there was if the application and Tomcat tried to timeout the request at the same time, it would basically do it twice. The processing the timeout twice wasn't a problem. The problem was it would then basically put the request back into the pool of requests to be reused twice, which meant subsequently two different requests could pull the same request object out, and you had two requests sharing a request object, which is a recipe for a disaster. I mean, at best, it's just not going to work properly. At worst, you end up having information shared between the requests, which is really bad. So, that got fixed. UTF-8, that was a denial of service in the UTF-8 parser. If you happen to send the right high-end UTF-8 bytes at the right point in the file that was being uploaded that ended up in the right point in Tomcat's internal buffers, you could hit an infinite loop. If you knew what was going on, it was dead easy to trigger, but it was actually it would be quite hard to trigger it accidentally or just as a generic attack. You had to get it in exactly the right place. Once you knew what you needed to do, it was easy. But it was one of those that was unlikely to stumble across. But one actually user found that in a normal use case. So we went through that and were able to debug it for them. And 8014, that was cause. Basic problem there was that cause defaults basically threw the cross-origin request security policy out of the window and allowed anything anywhere, which is the exact opposite of what you want cause to do. So we've changed it now. So basically, by default, it won't allow cross-origin requests. So then you have to explicitly open it up to enable the cross-origin requests that you want to allow. And of those, I would say the worst one is the async timeout, simply because it allowed the request mix-up. But it was something that was really difficult for a user to trigger. And you might possibly be able to trigger it for yourself, but then to exploit it depended on a lot on you being in the right place on the next sequence of requests. So it was very hard for an attacker to exploit. But if you're in a banking environment and customers seeing each other's data, then that's clearly bad. And you don't want that to happen. But they were all hard to exploit from that perspective. So some of them weren't great, but none of them were, oh my goodness, the sky is falling, panic, panic, panic. I think we had a fairly typical year, I'd say, in terms of security vulnerabilities, and I imagine that subsequent years will be about the same as well. In terms of new features we've done this time round, we've added the ability to change the TLS configuration without restarting Tomcat. So now you can update your certificates, and Tomcat will pick up the updated certificate without you having to stop it and start it. GSP compilation is multi-threaded. That will probably help if you pre-compile your GSPs before you do deployment. That should speed things up for you. We've added WebXML fragment support for the GSPC, and we've added OSGI metadata to all of the JAR files as well. And that's another one of those long-standing enhancement requests. And it's the sort of thing that only a few people ask for, but the people that ask for it, it's really, really useful if we get it right. So it's in there. It doesn't cost us anything to produce it now, apart from maybe a couple of seconds in the build time, so it's there and people can take advantage of it. I'll talk briefly about future plans, but Remy, I say, is going to talk more about that in the next session. In terms of Tomcat 8, every major Tomcat version is linked to a release of the servlet spec. And with the donation of Java EE to Eclipse, and that is a process that is still ongoing, you know, Tomcat 10 will be aligned to servlet next, whatever that ends up being called, whether it's 4.1, whether it's 5.0, whether it's Eclipse servlet 1.0. I think 5.0 would be my best guess at the minute, but we'll see. The original timescale was that Jakarta EE8, which was basically going to be all of the Java EE8 code ported across to Eclipse, put through Eclipse's IP process, built at Eclipse, and re-released. So basically no functional changes, just proof that everything had been transferred across and all the build processes were there. That was due in June, with the next iteration of the specs going to be due in December. Well, that's obviously slipped. When I wrote these slides, there were no firm plans. There are still no firm plans in terms of servlet, WebSocket, JSP, and EL.next. Current plans for the Jakarta EE8, or that's not an official name, whatever it gets, it might be EE for J8, I'm not quite sure at the minute. That's looking like November-ish, which means servlet next will be first half of next year. The most interesting thing in all of that at the moment for Tomcat is that a couple of weeks ago, the source code for all of the testing and compatibility kits, the TCKs, the things that Apache hasn't been able to get its hands on for a number of years, all landed in an open source GitHub repo. So the source for all of the TCKs is now available. What we haven't got is the build instructions. And having tried to build the TCK, I spent the best part of a day trying to figure out how to build it. Then I think there are a couple of pieces still missing, and there's definitely an order you have to build it in for it to work, and I haven't figured out what it is yet. But those instructions have been, the build instructions have been promised, they are coming. So in the not too distant future, we'll be in a position where we'll actually be able to build our own copy of the TCK and run it against Tomcat and see what it finds. We might find that actually it passes and everything's hunky-dory. We might find there's a couple of edge case bugs that we haven't seen so far. So it'll be interesting to get those TCKs and run them. So when, obviously, Tomcat 10 will implement servlet next, whatever that might be. Other plans we've got for Tomcat 10, we're looking at removing the APR native connector. The main reasons for having that there are less so these days, particularly now we can integrate OpenSSL for encryption in the normal Java connectors. So there's the potential to remove a connector. That removes quite a bit of code. It's the least stable of all of them. It's the one that's most likely to crash the JVM. So there are good reasons for moving to using just OpenSSL as a pure encryption engine rather than using APR to do the I.O. We want to support OpenSSL clones, so LibreSSL and the half a dozen other ones that there are, just get our code working with your particular fork of choice. And generally around the native code, just clean things up, because yeah, that code was pretty old when I joined the project, and it hasn't really evolved that much since, so want to make sure that we clean that up. On the HTTP2 side, that works pretty well. Functionally, no major concerns, but it is fairly heavy on the amount of garbage it generates and the resources it uses. So we want to see what can we do to make that a bit more efficient. So that's on the to-do list. Reactive I.O., there'll be some sessions on that either later today or tomorrow. Essentially, it's a way of handling back pressure and scaling. There's a chance it'll be included in servlet.next. If that's the case, then obviously we'll need to implement it. We've actually got a lot of the hooks already in Tomcat anyway, but we'll take a look at that as and when we have eyes on servlet.next. Another possibility is cloud clustering. So at the minute, you've got two options if you want to configure clustering. Either you do it statically, where you identify each member, or you do it dynamically, which uses multicast. What you haven't really got is a way for some sort of cloud infrastructure to say, "Ooh, I've spun up another Tomcat instance, add this new instance to the cluster." So we want to provide a mechanism for doing that, so it's easier to create Tomcat clusters in the cloud. And John, that's something that John Frederick's working on. So that's my quick-ish canter through what we've been doing for the last year and a short view of our future plans. By my reckoning, I've got about 4 minutes left before my time runs out and I get dragged kicking and screaming off stage. So do you have any questions? That one. Yes, question about that. Oh, this is going to be difficult. It's Chris. So I'll repeat the question for the benefit of the recording. Do I think we can get away with dropping AJP anytime soon? That's the separate protocol that we use to proxy content, or you can use to proxy content from HTTP or other web servers to Tomcat. I think no, and the reason I think no is when I went looking for HTTPD, yes, no problem, we don't need it. We could do everything with HTTP, it would be fine. The problem is IIS. There are the features you get if you use the IIS and the modules that are available, you don't have as much control over load balancing. That's where the problem is. From memory, I think the case is if you can get it to do a load balancing to a cluster, what you can't get it to do is if a request to one node fails, to get it to fail over to another node, it just bounces the failure straight back to the client. And I'm going from memory, but when that particular feature request was presented in whichever bug tracker that IIS or forum I was reading, the response from the IIS devs was, why would anybody ever want to do that? So from that point of view, I think we need to keep it because it's keeping the features available for IIS. But if other load balancing solutions become available for IIS, then that really does remove the, well, why do I need AJP? It's not really the protocol that we need, it's the load balancing and the failover features that we get with the ISAPI redirector. And if there's an alternative, find an alternative to those, then I think you can remove AJP and ModJK. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's kind of a, yes, we could do that, but that's a huge amount of work, and we've got something that works at the minute very well. Thank you very much. So I don't see that happening realistically, to be honest. I've got about a minute left. Any more questions? Well, if you do think of any questions, either later today or later this week, I'll be around for until Thursday afternoon. Next couple of days, I'll be wearing my Tomcat T-shirt, so you'll be able to find me really easily. After that, I'm afraid you have to remember what I look like. Otherwise, thank you much for your attention. I hope you enjoyed the rest of today.